From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Chemical weapons, the Red Line, and the U.S. in Syria. Hello again, I'm Aaron Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Horrific reports, including grisly video, show that chemical weapons have killed hundreds in Syria, including children. Has President Obama's red line been crossed? Rebel forces blame the Assad regime, while Assad claims the rebels did it to trigger support from international forces. UN inspectors have arrived in the country, but they've not been allowed to visit the scene. If they were, could they prove the case one way or the other? We'll hear what President Obama said today about a host of bad options and what it would take for the U.S. to intervene. Today's talking point, Al Jazeera America, the new cable news network. First, the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. President Obama is under increased pressure to intervene in Syria's civil war, which spilled over into neighboring Lebanon once again today. We'll have updates and analysis of the president's options. Today's talking point, a new cable TV network, says Americans are missing real news. We'll talk with the president of Al Jazeera America, a veteran of 30 years with ABC News. First, this news update. A year ago, President Obama said the use of chemical weapons would be a red line for the U.S., an apparent threat to intervene in Syria. This week, rebel forces released a ghastly video, which appears to show children among the hundreds allegedly killed in poison gas attacks by military forces. On CNN today, President Obama called it a big event of grave concern. He was asked if the red line has been crossed. Here's his response.
If the U.S. goes in and attacks another country without a U.N. mandate and without clear evidence that can be presented, then there are questions in terms of whether international law supports it, do we have the coalition to make it work, and those are considerations that we have to take into account.
President Obama speaking today on CNN. Karen DeYoung is senior diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Always good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Good to be here.
So the president says you need a UN mandate, you need clear evidence, and you need a coalition of other countries in order to pull this off. What's he doing to achieve those three things?
Well, I think he's calling all of our allies and consulting deeply. He's pushing for the UN investigators already on the ground in Damascus to be given permission to go and examine the site of this alleged attack. And his administration is reexamining its options. These are options that have been on the table for a long, long time. But I thought overall, while the president expressed horror and concern about what happened, I thought he was pretty temperate in saying, we're not going to do anything, certainly not by ourselves there.
Are there pressures on him, not just from Republicans, but from Democrats and from in the White House itself?
Well, yeah, there are in all of those places. Whether those are the kind of majority of feeling or not, I think is not clear. And that's been the case throughout with Syria. I think that there's been a pretty even division within the administration, with the State Department being kind of in the forefront, along with some people in the White House pushing for some kind of action. Again, this precedes this week's event. And the Pentagon kind of hanging back, saying, look, you need to play out this tape and see where we're going to end up if we intervene and whether we're going to achieve the goals we want or make things worse. In Congress, certainly the loudest voices have been calling for more robust intervention, but I think that it's not at all clear whether those are the majority of voices, because many people have said, no, we think that the United States should not get involved. And the administration's very aware of public opinion. I think they have their own polls, and they see public opinion polls where a great many Americans say, look, we're just getting out of those wars. We don't want to get into another one.
The president remarked about that today himself when he was talking to CNN, said, look, we're already trying to get out of Afghanistan. And he doesn't know. He suggested whether there would be public support for doing anything more now in Syria. When you say the Pentagon has warned that it's possible to make this worse, what do you mean?
Well, I think that if you look at a letter that General Dempsey, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, sent to a congressman this week, in which he pretty much spelled out his views that he's discussed before, although not quite as strongly. He said, look, the opposition in Syria is completely divided. If we help one group, does that ensure that that group is going to prevail? No, not at all. I think humanitarian aid, promoting the political opposition, which up until very recently has been the sole policy of the administration, is the way to go and is most likely to achieve our aims. I think they think that people like John McCain throw around kind of cavalierly the suggestion that we have a no-fly zone over Syria, certain areas of Syria, without really understanding what that entails.
Senator McCain of Arizona has actually said it would be easy to do that.
Right. He has said that. The Pentagon says it's not so easy.
Not so easy to take out various installations, throw up a no-fly zone, and then presumably escalate the situation, and I guess it would involve other countries as well.
Well, and I think that the Pentagon has also said, they've repeated on a number of occasions, that their assessment of civilian casualties in Iraq, and I'm sorry I keep saying Iraq, it shows Syria, is that of what some say now are more than 100,000 dead, only about 10% of them have died because of air action by the Syrian government, and that's what would be affected by any kind of U.S. air action. It certainly wouldn't affect the use of chemical weapons if, in fact, that's what's happened.
Bringing us up to date from Washington, Karen DeYoung, senior diplomatic correspondent at The Washington Post. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Back in a moment with To the Point. We'll continue this conversation about Syria from To the Point once again on PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the conflict in Syria, which once again has spilled over into neighboring Lebanon. Two explosions, apparently timed to strike at the end of Friday prayers, hit two mosques in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli today. At least 42 people are reported killed, hundreds injured. Erica Solomon is a correspondent for Reuters in Beirut. That's about 45 miles south of Tripoli. Erica Solomon, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
What more can you tell us about what's happening in Lebanon?
Well, this double bombing that happened in Tripoli is actually, according to our estimates, the largest bomb to hit the northern port city since Lebanon's own civil war between 1975 and 1990. And it's definitely, Tripoli has actually been one of the first sort of points for conflict whenever there's a new event in Syria. Today's bombing is definitely different. It's a sign of an escalation, and it seems definitely linked to a bombing that happened last week in the southern Beirut suburb of Dahiya, which targeted an area controlled by the militant group Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a Shiite group that's been backing President Bashar al-Assad in Syria, publicly so, and they've committed forces to Assad's fight against the rebels. And now, today in Tripoli, we have this double bombing, which targeted Sunnis who are from the same majority group that is leading the revolt in Syria. So it's tied into the fighting in Syria in a lot of ways about ideological and political loyalties, but also it's a sign of now how the problems of Syria are taking on their own dimensions in Lebanon that are much bloodier than before.
In the meantime, what can you tell us about Syria itself, and particularly the light weapons and ammunition that the United States has promised to at least some of the rebel forces there?
Well, the first, actually, I think the last time I spoke to you, Warren, was for the same sort of promises. And, of course, we've actually seen very little ammunition arrive to the rebels. There has been more aid they've talked about, more potentially more strategic support or training, but little ammunition on the ground. Some rebel forces have been saying that they've been hearing more and more that they're going to get more of these ammunitions. But frankly, the rebels, if you talk to them, they're not really holding their breath for anything from the United States or even from the UN, for that matter, after this latest incident around Damascus of the chemical weapons or alleged chemical weapons attack.
Well, what about the concern expressed by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and others that if we arm some rebels, other rebels are likely to get the arms and they'll be the wrong ones, the ones that are supporting al-Qaeda or perhaps al-Qaeda organizations themselves?
That is true. I mean, that is a risk. It's probably not even a risk. It's probably, frankly, guaranteed that they won't be able to control who gets these weapons. And of course, people who supported American intervention early on say, you know, this is a perfect example of why we should have done something sooner when there wasn't this radical Islamist force that was gaining momentum. But of course, that's hindsight. The question of arming, I mean, it's sort of at this point, to be frank, the radical groups have their own system, which is very effective for getting weapons. They don't really need American weapons. The ones who need them are the ones who are the more moderate groups or not taken by this ideology. But even if you sent them weapons, the bigger problem is structure. It's not even about would those weapons leak to radical groups. The problem is that these groups are actually fighting amongst themselves now for various reasons. And until the foreign powers in cooperation with the political opposition abroad find a way to create some type of hierarchy, to streamline control and direction of opposition forces, arming is sort of beside the point. So I think if the United States or any foreign power wanted to play a really effective role, it would be to try and solve that crisis, which is really the biggest problem that the armed rebel forces have right now.
One of the things suggested by the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is humanitarian aid as a way of getting support for the United States, I gather. How difficult is that?
Well, I mean, I think that question, it goes actually back to the United States. U.S. groups have already been giving a lot of aid. In fact, they're the largest contributors to humanitarian aid in Syria, but they don't want to publicize that. And it's sort of a catch-22. You know, if you publicize it, you risk putting the people who work with you in danger because obviously, you know, a lot of groups, especially the more extremist groups, accuse, you know, anyone who was working with the Americans of being CIA or whatever. But so they don't want to announce that they are giving this aid. But when they don't announce that they're giving aid, they're seen as, you know, basically watching while Syrian people die. So I think before they even talk about giving more aid, at least in terms of American interests, of course, their question has to be whether or not they're willing to step up and play a role publicly as a supporter of humanitarian aid.
You've mentioned that we've spoken before, and we've talked about from time to time about how well the rebels were doing. At one point, it appeared that they really might be able to march on Damascus. Now, does it appear that President Assad and the forces of the government are really in charge?
The general consensus is that Assad's forces have gained the momentum in the fight in Syria, but it's a very much a regionalized issue now. So we talk a lot about Assad's forces having gained ground, and that's true when we talk about central Syria and areas around Damascus, which is their priority. But when you get to northern Syria and the east, it's not so clear. In fact, there's been a lot of rebel gains, mostly from these Al-Qaeda-linked groups that the United States and other Western powers are so wary of. So what we're seeing more and more is a de facto division of Syria. It's, you know, people still talk about it as a very distant possibility, politically speaking, but in terms of the reality on the ground, it's already a reality.
Erica Solomon again, a correspondent for Reuters based in Beirut. Let's turn back to the issue of the chemical weapons. Amy Smithson is with us. She's senior fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, chair of the Global Affairs Council on Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Weapons for the World Economic Forum. Thank you very much for being on our program.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
We know now that there are UN weapons inspectors on the ground in Syria. They have the mission of going in, if they can get in, to determine whether or not chemical weapons have, in fact, been used. That's about as far as their mission would take them. They don't have the obligation of determining who used the weapons. Would it be possible for them, if they were allowed in, to do that?
Well, in a certain sense, it becomes a process of deduction. If they are allowed to these most recent attack sites, then that's a very debatable question at this point, although there's a lot of political pressure, including even from Russia, on the Syrian government to allow that access to these latest sites. If the inspectors get there and there are remnants from munitions, like rockets, then the parties in the area that are the likely perpetrators of this get narrowed down considerably. That would be the Syrian government and perhaps an outside group like Hezbollah. But the rebel forces simply don't have that capability. At this point, all they have is kind of do-it-yourself rockets. And so if they can get in there, find some rocket fragments and take samples and that reveal chemical contents that are consistent with the victims of this attack, then you start to narrow down the possibilities quite considerably.
What do we know about the stockpiles that the Assad regime has?
Well, for quite some time, they've been in the chemical weapons business going back a few decades. At first, they leaned very heavily on outside assistance from countries like Egypt. Russia has provided assistance, Iran, North Korea, whether it's chemicals, technical advice, or delivery systems. But at this point, they have a domestic capability. In fact, facilities have even been identified where they do research and development production of chemical warfare agents and munitions.
Based on your expertise and what you have seen of the video that's been released and the other information that we know about about the incident that has taken place this week, what do you think?
Well, it's abundantly clear to anybody who views the videos, especially the videos of the children who simply can't be coached to have physical reactions like that, that they have been exposed to a toxic chemical. What toxic chemical is involved, in a certain sense, is actually immaterial because the Chemical Weapons Convention prohibits the use of any toxic chemical for military purposes. Syria is not a signatory of that treaty, but it is a member of the 1925 Geneva Protocol, which prohibits use. And there are 188 countries that belong to the Chemical Weapons Convention, so that makes it customary international law. This is a violation of international law, whoever did it.
And you're certain, then, that that has taken place, that as you say, given the behavior of the children who would be difficult to coach, there's no question in your mind that the toxic chemical has been there?
Yes. I have no doubt that this is a toxic chemical event. You don't see in these videos any wounds or injuries typical of conventional weapons exchange, gunshot wounds, shrapnel from bombs, broken bones, lots of blood. These are people who are convulsing, twitching, foaming at the mouth. And again, a lot of toxic chemicals can cause those types of symptoms, but which chemical it is, again, is not the material issue here.
Back to Erica Solomon quickly with Reuters in Beirut. Is that what you're hearing as well? And is that the same kind of information you're getting from people who've looked at the evidence?
Basically, most people feel that the abundance of videos that we have, the different sites, all just there's so much evidence. It seems overwhelming. that a lot of experts who look at it say that they just feel it's impossible that this was somehow staged. I mean, there's still a lot of people, you know, with who say that it's a possibility, you know, sort of unsure how or why, but who say it's technically possible that these videos were faked. But I would say most outside experts believe that just the sheer quantity makes it unlikely that it's any that something happened.
Amy Smithson, the Russians are saying that the evidence is vague and that it might have been possible that the rebels themselves used these weapons in order to try to get international support for an assault of some sort against the Assad regime. How credible is that theory?
Well, look at the capabilities that one can reasonably assume the rebels to have. For starters, they don't have rockets, and that's the reported delivery system here. So you can take that off the list of capabilities they would need to do this. And can they manufacture that quantity of chemicals? They might be able to manufacture a beaker or two if they've got access to a laboratory. But if again, the reports are accurate that this was not just one, but a bunch of rockets landing with chemicals, then that's likely to be beyond their capability. And the other telltale sign here is that these attacks occurred almost at the same time in the wee hours of the morning, and that is right out of the chemical warfare military doctrine playbook for achieving maximal effectiveness in a chemical attack. Because in the early hours of the morning, the temperatures are going to be cooler, the winds will be very low, and whatever gas is released is going to hang over the target and continue to have its effects, as opposed to an attack in the middle of the day where the wind will sweep it off target.
Do we know where the stockpiles are that the Syrian government has? Would it be possible for those to be taken out without a great loss of life or otherwise, causing more destruction than just that?
Taking out a facility that is filled with toxic chemicals is very risky business to begin with. High incendiary munitions can do this, but whether or not you start enough of a fire to really burn it all up is very doubtful and difficult to achieve in the first place. Knowing for sure that you've identified all the sites that are in the control of al-Assad and his military forces where these chemicals are located and munitions are located is, again, a very difficult thing to do, and I think something that the intelligence community at this point would concede. So if you don't get all the sites, then you end up in a situation where you perhaps trigger his threat to use chemical weapons in the event of outside intervention, and that's on top of the toxic clouds that you might release by bombing these sites in the first place.
Amy Smithson again with the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. Erica Solomon with Reuters, we need to go to a break, and we have just one more minute with you. But why would there be an attack by the Assad regime of this nature, given the timing with the UN inspectors in the area? Who are there any theories about that?
You know, Warren, this is something that we as journalists asked ourselves when we first heard the news, and it made everyone scratch their heads. But to be honest, it's hard to imagine anyone who benefits from this. I mean, the opposition groups will point back and say, why would we go and kill the children of our own fighters and the wives as well as men? Either way, no one, I think, has come up with a very sensible reason as to why someone would want to do this right now.
Erica Solomon with Reuters, and many thanks. We'll be back, continue this conversation on our Talking Point. We'll talk with the president of Al Jazeera America, the new cable news network. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Here's more of President Obama's remarks today on CNN about intervention in Syria.
Sometimes what we've seen is that folks will call for immediate action, jumping into stuff that does not turn out well, gets us mired in very difficult situations, can result in us being drawn in to very expensive, difficult, costly interventions that actually breed more resentment in the region.
Let me introduce Stephen Simon, waiting patiently for our in our program, a former White House senior director for the Middle East and North Africa during the Obama administration, now executive director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. It's great to have you on our program, and thanks very much for being with us.
Likewise.
We have heard a lot of people saying, not on this program, but previous to it, although somebody did mention it at one point, that had we acted sooner, the United States wouldn't be in the position where it is now, with so many bad options and apparently no good options whatsoever. How do you respond to those kinds of criticisms?
I really don't know how to respond to counterfactuals of that kind. You know, it's like saying if my grandmother had had wheels, she'd have been a car. You know. I'm a bit actually puzzled because the intervention, the most robust forms of intervention that had been conceived of, I don't know, 6 months ago or a year ago, would not have changed the trajectory of the conflict, which is, you know, as we see, a profound civil war in Syria.
So you don't think, then, that delay on the part of the United States and the rest of the international community has been what has allowed the rebel forces to be divided, for the more militant forces to come in and apparently take over or attempt to take over the effort against the Assad regime?
Yeah, well, look, there's an extensive political science literature on the role of outside assistance to parties contending for power in civil wars. And the one conclusion that's relatively clear from this historical literature is that the more that comes in from outside, the more fractionated, the more divided the rebels are, because the outside aid creates a market with competing forces in it, trying to get what's coming in and maximize its use. So, you know, I rather think that if we had been putting stuff in, it would have hastened and worsened the divisions that you're seeing within the opposition. I don't think that, and I certainly don't think that those divisions could somehow be healed or bridged by weapons coming in from the outside. Now, in any case, the United States has apparently decided to do this, or so I read.
So you read, but apparently no evidence as yet very much in the way of materiel flowing in there. What about Senator McCain and others, but particularly Senator McCain, who has said often that it would really be easy just to take out the facilities that delivered the chemical weapons, if in fact they were fired by rockets by the military, and to establish a no-fly zone over the country of Syria?
Well, that the United States has the capacity to do this is beyond question. I mean, Senator McCain is right about that. In fact, we could wipe out the Syrian army and, you know, extirpate the regime by military force without breathing hard. We showed in Iraq that we could do that. So I don't question that. I mean, the issue is what next? And we know from Iraq that as well. So, you know, just because we can do something doesn't mean, it seems to me, on the basis of our experience as a nation, that it's something we ought to do.
Stephen Simon again, formerly with the Obama White House, Senior Director for the Middle East and North Africa, now Executive Director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Amr al-Azam is Syrian, who is an active member of the Syrian opposition, but here in the United States. He's also Associate Professor of History at Shawnee State University in Ohio. It's good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What do you say to what we just heard from Stephen Simon, that we couldn't have done anything from the start to prevent the situation from deteriorating to the point where it is now?
Right. Well, you know, I strongly disagree with Stephen. And Stephen and I have had a conversation way back when it all started. This is back in June 2011. And I've also had conversations with people at State Department and other places when right at the very beginning, when there was no armed element, when it was just, you know, unarmed civilians going out protesting and the regime shooting indiscriminately at them. At that time, we know from our own inside sources, from within the regime, and this is remember this, you've got to put this into context of what was happening in Libya at the time, with the big intervention in Libya, with the bombing of Gaddafi's forces. The Syrian regime was very worried. It was very concerned. It didn't know where the red line was. It didn't know how far it could go. And so I know then, and I remember distinctly, there was one incident in July when there was that column of tanks driving towards Deir ez-Zor, which is a city in the eastern part of Syria, close to the Iraqi border. And had all it took, all it would have taken is one predator to take out the lead tank. And we know that because this was a test by the regime, and we were told this is a test by the regime, to see how far they could go. Could they take their army? Could they take their military and suppress a city? And they went in and they suppressed the city, and they torched and looted and destroyed the commercial center of that city. Had they just hit the lead tank, that column would have gone back home, and it would have changed the entire course of this war. We could have done something in those days, in those early days, in those early months. Now, of course, it's a very different game. And then to come to the other side of the question, what can we do now? I mean, everybody's talking about arming the rebels. I mean, I have to agree. Now, you know, Syria's awash with weapons, and most of these radical Islamist and extremist groups have their own means of getting weapons, and they have plenty of weapons. What we need now, I don't necessarily think is, because there are two ways. You can either throw more weapons in, obviously, or you can do better still. The United States can provide assertive leadership. It can step up to the plate and say, right, I am really going to take charge. You know, Kuwait, Qatar, and whoever else is supplying those radical Islamists with weapons, stop doing that. And more importantly, you need to send the regime a very clear and, message, show it exactly where the red line is, and support that with a clear demonstration of what happens if that red line is breached. So you say to the regime, the next time you fire a Scud missile at a civilian population, the next time you fire a Scud missile loaded with chemical weapons, the next time you use your air force to bomb civilian targets, I'm going to destroy that air base, I'm going to destroy that missile site. And you can do that without putting any U.S. personnel in danger. And I believe McCain and many other people have already talked about this. So there are other ways of dealing with this. It's not about, oh, well, we have to give arms and then they'll end up in the wrong hands. And it's not about, oh, well, if we had hindsight or there was nothing we could have done, there's nothing we could have done in the past would have changed the trajectory of the conflict.
Amr al-Azam, again, part of the Syrian opposition, associate professor of history at Shawnee State University in Ohio. Back to Stephen Simon, formerly with the Obama White House. Several points have been made. Let's take them one by one. First, a single predator could have taken out the tank, and the test would have been over, according to Mr. al-Azam.
Well, I guess we'll never know. I mean, I personally am skeptical. If you look at a grim determination that the Assad regime has brought to this conflict, I simply find it implausible that this regime would simply have backed down if one of its tanks had been destroyed by a U.S. missile at that juncture.
What about the idea, then, of exercising leadership now, first by insisting to Kuwait and Qatar and others that have been arming the regime and helping the situation to cut it out?
Well, there's a difference between leadership and the ability to coerce, although, they overlap, of course, in some circumstances. The United States has exercised serious leadership in a number of important ways. First of all, it's the United States that has galvanized the enormous humanitarian assistance effort that's at work both within Syria and on its borders. And that effort is going to, get more intense as time goes on, as I suppose we all know. Secondly, it was the United States that attempted to start the Geneva process to begin with. It was the United States that galvanized allies to work ultimately unsuccessfully with the Russians on a diplomatic and political process to deal with this crisis. And it's the United States that set up this process of developing the ability of opposition local councils within Syria to govern the areas that they control, so as to, in effect, begin creating the post-Assad Syria from those areas in Syria from which regime military power has receded. And those areas are very significant in size. So there's been, it seems to me, a great deal of American leadership. What the United States cannot do is go to Qatar or go to the United Arab Emirates and somehow force them to curtail weapon shipments to a cause that they think is extremely important. And it's been reported, perhaps accurately, that there is a coordination mechanism at work involving the United States and these other countries, which is having a positive effect on the way weapons going into Syria are distributed. But as one of the other speakers in the program, I think, said very, very wisely earlier, once those weapons are in Syria, precisely because they do form a currency, if you will, their distribution and use becomes very difficult to control for donors.
Back to Amal al-Azam, I think you agreed with that final point, but not the others. Let me ask you about what the president had to say today, that first you have to verify that it was, in fact, the regime that used the chemical weapons. Secondly, you have to get a U.N. Resolution in order to make it legal to take action, which Russia and China seem to be preventing. Thirdly, you have to have a coalition of forces. Do any of those things, do you think, exist to the point where we could take action and get away with it?
I mean, in terms of verification, I mean, obviously, I mean, there's no doubt you need to verify. I mean, and nobody wants to go to war again against a country just on a fantasy like we did in Iraq, or that there might be WMDs or so forth. But in this case, and I think both your guests earlier on the program made very convincing arguments, in my opinion, as to why the most likely culprit here is the regime. One, the delivery mechanism are, you know, the rockets, the Scud rockets, which we know the opposition has none, and you know that chemical weapons are not like sprinkling frosties on your cake or on your morning cereal. I mean, this is serious stuff. It's very delicate. It's a very precise process, and you know there are special warheads specifically designed to carry these kind of payloads, and only the Syrian regime has them. Okay, so I think in terms of verification, I mean, it's all well and good for the president to say that, and I understand why he would say that, but really, you know, we know who used that. We know who has this kind of equipment. We know that it's only the regime who has these kind of rockets and delivery mechanisms, and therefore to suggest otherwise is really bogus. When it comes to the United Nations, I mean, again, I understand why, and we do want, I mean, ideally you do want consensus. You do want a coalition, a broad coalition of willing partners who would be willing to go in and take part in a much longer and sustained campaign. But nobody's talking about that right now. All we're talking about right now is establishing, you know, some assertive leadership. You don't need the United Nations for assertive leadership, and you don't need a coalition for assertive leadership. You just need to, you know, right now, you know, there's nobody in charge of the Syria problem. And you know, I mean, I understand what Steve was saying about the issue of humanitarian assistance. Yes, the United States has played a huge role in providing humanitarian assistance, but that's not what we're discussing. We're not discussing whether enough humanitarian assistance has been supplied or not. We're talking about how do we stop the violence? How do we reduce the level of violence. And one of the best and most effective ways to reduce this level of violence is to make it clear to the regime that it cannot continue to use certain types of weapons against civilians. This includes weapons of mass destruction and the use of, you know, its air force against civilians. And even if you look at, just even if we talk about the air force, how many, I mean, there are so many attacks, and we know this from personal experience, from personal conversations with, you know, rebel forces on the ground. So many attacks end up failing because the regime is able to bring its air force to bear on any attack. It blunts the attacks.
I'm going to give Stephen Simon an opportunity to respond because we are running short of time. I apologize for interrupting. But Stephen Simon, what about it? Would the kind of thing that the professor is talking about bring in other countries? Would it cause a what might the Russians and Chinese do in the event that the United States took that kind of action? Can you just briefly tell us what you think the consequences might be?
Well, I think were the U.S. to do this, it would put itself first in the middle of a civil war in Syria, but also into a proxy war with Iran and more distantly with the Russians in Syria, you know, to determine Syria's fate. And, you know, this is a proxy war in which the United States, if it chose to get into it, would have to win. Would have to win it. And that might not be so easy because the Iranians, given their proximity, given their control over Hezbollah, are in a position to outbid the United States to go farther up the escalatory ladder in Syria than does the United States. And, you know, there's a simple reason for this. And setting aside capabilities, it's so that, you know, for Iran and for Hezbollah, the fate of Syria is an existential issue. It's a truly strategic issue. For the United States, the stakes are much less clear. And where you have a disparity between two sides, and to the degree that, you know, each side stakes its future on the outcome of a battle, the side with the stronger commitment is the one that's going to have the better chance of winning.
Okay, very quickly. Amy Smithson is still with us. We have about 30 seconds left. Amy Smithson, any final comment that you would like to make, again, with the Center for Nonproliferation Studies?
The ideal first step here to reduce the loss of life is for all the nations who are members of the Chemical Weapons Convention, that's 188, to provide defensive assistance, flood Syria with defensive assistance for the civilians and for the rebel fighters. The United States and the United Kingdom have already decided to do this. This should be one thing that the international community should be able to agree on as a first step, is that that level of violence can be reduced.
Do you see the United States doing anything in that regard?
Well, they have announced that they're providing defensive assistance a few weeks ago. Tom Countryman mentioned it in one of his series of remarks. And I've been encouraging this from the outset of signs that chemicals were entering this conflict, because it is a no-brainer thing to do when you can't necessarily pinpoint with 100% assurance who's responsible for the use of chemicals.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. Amy Smithson again with the Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. Steve Simon, formerly with the Obama administration, now executive director at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Amar al-Azam at Shawnee State University in Ohio. And our earlier guest, Erica Solomon, with Reuters in Beirut. Great to have all of you on our program, and thank you very much. In a promotional video, Al Jazeera America shows bickering politicos on Fox News and MSNBC and quotes favorable comments from Hillary Clinton, with the narrator ending up saying, "You have the right to know what's happening and the right to make up your own mind." We'll talk with the president of the latest thing in cable TV in a moment on To the Point.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
We're in Alney back with today's talking point. Al Jazeera America, a 24-hour cable news channel that launched in this country on Tuesday. It's owned by the royal family of Qatar, which used its oil fortune to pay $500 million for what used to be Current TV. Al Jazeera America has hired more than 400 journalists, including some well-known anchors, and it's opened 12 bureaus in the United States. One of its first stories was about gangs and guns in Chicago.
The crime-plagued South and West Side neighborhoods of Chicago are only a few miles away from the city's glitzy Miracle Mile, but they might as well be in another world. The poverty rate among African Americans here is 32%, the highest in the nation. 9 out of 10 shootings in the city occur in this part of town. Most involve teenagers.
Once again, the beginning of a report on Al Jazeera America. The president of that organization is a veteran of 30 years with ABC News. She is Kate O'Brien. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Warren.
What does that story about Chicago say about your intentions for Al Jazeera America?
Well, our intentions, the mission of Al Jazeera America is really to give voice to the voiceless and to present people with news stories from areas that are, we think, traditionally underserved. There has been Chicago. The Chicago story in itself is something that I think has been around. Certainly, other mainstream news divisions have done that story before. But it is illustrative of the kinds of stories and the way in which we want to tell those stories from all over the country. We feel that. The certainly in the cable news world, there tends to be a reliance on punditry and Washington and New York centered news coverage, and we really want to take our news coverage to the whole country.
What about the association with Qatar and the fact that this comes from despite the fact that Al Jazeera has won Peabody Awards, Polk Awards, Robert F. Kennedy Awards, it was seen and has been labeled as a kind of mouthpiece for the enemy ever since the Bush administration, in the words of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, that may be what some people said about Al Jazeera at this point a decade ago. Al Jazeera is not a mouthpiece for the Qatari royal family or for anybody. It is an independent, editorially independent. Al Jazeera America is an editorially independent news organization. As you said in the intro, I come from a history of mainstream news journalism at ABC News. I am certainly well steeped in. You know, the independence, the editorial independence of the American news media, and I wouldn't be here at Al Jazeera if I were not 100% convinced that that is where we are going to stay.
What would you do if, for example, there were pressures from the owners in Qatar to cover Israel in a certain way or to deal with the situation in Syria, where Qatar has, in fact, been supportive of the Assad regime?
Well, I'm not going to make statements about what I would or wouldn't do on anything. I go back to what I just said, which is we are editorially independent. We have had, and I think this is true, I know this is true of our sister network, Al Jazeera English. We have not had anybody in ever said to us in our history of 3.5 days, slant a story this way, do a story that way, cover this or don't cover that, and that's how I expect it to be for the duration of my tenure here, however long that is.
My apologies. It's the jihadis that apparently the Qataris are arming. But let's get back to what you're actually doing. How will Al Jazeera America be different from Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN?
Well, I think there are a number of ways in which we are different. One very simple one is that we are on 24/7, 365 days a year. We have 14 hours of live news a day, and that includes weekends. That's something that the other cable channels just haven't been able to do. It is a way in which, you know, we feel very strongly that we need to be in the space where, if at any time during the day or night or on the weekends. People need to see what's going on and want to find real news. They can find us. We have news segments, short news updates, even at the top of our programs, our pre-recorded documentaries and mini-docs. We start with 90 seconds of a news update on every hour. So we really are there 24/7. So that's one way. The second way is the mission of Al Jazeera is truly to report on the underreported parts of the country. And it's one of the reasons why we have put bureaus in places that really aren't places that national news organizations place bureaus. You know, Nashville, Detroit, Denver. We're looking at other places. We have 12 right now, and we're going to expand and going to be in more places. We want to find the stories that are the stories of the local areas that are great stories. We don't want to just be reporting what comes out of Washington or what comes out of New York. And by hiring people into those bureaus who are from those areas, so, you know, in Seattle, we have a team that is from Seattle. They are really well positioned and have the history of knowing what's important in that area, and they can make sure that we're putting stories on the air that go to places that you're not going to see anyplace else.
Are you worried about building audience when you focus on a local news to that extent?
Not if the stories are told in a compelling and engaging way. No, I'm not really worried about it. I've received many emails and calls from people who are watching our programming and saying, wow, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Hey, there's a story that I hadn't heard before. And they are, listen, all news is local at some point. And there are stories that start out locally, but they're great stories. And that's what we want to be able to highlight.
Okay, Al Jazeera America, Kate O'Brien, president, formerly with ABC News. Thanks a lot for joining us. Come back and talk to us again.
I'll be happy to. Thanks, Warren.
All right. To the Point, produced this week by Christian Bordahl, Carrie Cavanaugh, Katie Cooper, Evan George, Anna Scott, and Caitlin Schamberg. Technical director Mike Newport, managing producer Sonia Geis. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.